Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.
You're listening to NPR News. I'm Angela Davis. Good to have you join us. Hey, how's your garden looking? Are you ready for fall planting? Are you wondering if you should keep the changing climate in mind while designing your fall garden? Fall gardening can present some challenges for experienced and novice gardeners alike. What winters over well? When should you deadhead your plants? How do you anticipate an early frost? And this year, drought conditions across the state mean additional challenges for gardeners. So today, I'm talking with two master gardeners about their advice on what to plant with climate change in mind and other important fall gardening concerns. And I definitely want to hear from you. The phone lines are open. What are you planning this season? How has the drought affected your yard, your trees, your plants? What questions do you have for our gardening experts? Call us at this number, 651-227-6000. Again, 651-227-6000. You can also write to me on Twitter. I'm at Angela Davis, NPR. Let's bring in our guest for the hour. We have Julie Weisenhorn with us. Julie is an extension educator and associate extension professor in the University of Minnesota's Department of Horticultural Science. Hi, Julie, and welcome back to the show.
Hi, Angela. It's great to be here. Thank you.
Catherine Grant is also with us. Catherine is a horticulturalist and greenhouse manager in the Department of Biology at the University of St. Thomas. Good morning, Catherine, and welcome back to you as well.
Good morning, Angela. It's nice to be back.
You're my gardening dream team. So I'm glad that the two of you were available today to talk about this. And Julie, as the summer gardening season ends and fall approaches, you know, what do we typically start to see happen in our gardens around this time of the year?
Well, it has been one tough year for gardeners, I think. The drought and the heat have really stressed our plants. So I think what we're seeing right now is we've had a little bit of recovery because we've had some rain. I had a little over an inch at my house just yesterday, and that was very welcome. But I've seen a lot of my plants already going downhill for the year, which is pretty normal for this time of year. But it seems that some of the flowers maybe didn't last quite as long. Some of the native plants did great. They really are tough plants and kept their flowers quite a long time this summer. But I think right now we're starting to see just plants declining, going into dormancy. We can be, you know, still looking for pollinators and still enjoying some of the fall blooming plants. But it's kind of typical for this time of year to start to see this.
And I think about, you know, when we were planting everything this spring, we were all excited. Everything, all the colors were vibrant and, you know, everything was getting bigger and better. And now we're kind of on the decline is how it looks.
Right. And that again is normal for this time of year. We've got some cool evening temperatures, which is relieving the plants somewhat from some of the heat that we've had and some of the stress. But it's time for plants to start going into dormancy.
Catherine, much of the state has been under some level of drought conditions this summer. So what can you tell us about how that is affecting what people may be seeing in their gardens right now?
Right. Well, I think you're seeing the effect of drought on many levels in different types of plants. For instance, your trees, maybe whether or not you were able to give them supplemental water this summer, you might be seeing a leaf scorch on them or some dieback in your trees and shrubs, things that just were unable to hydrate themselves during the hot, dry summer that we just had. And then your perennials and such also, like Julie said, they're going into sort of a natural decline this time of year, but also the drought, if you weren't unable to water them or you didn't water them, they are going to be showing lots of signs of wilt and dieback and just general lack of good health as they go into the fall because it was just so hard on them. this year.
And then was there really anything we could do during the drought that would have, you know, helped these plants and trees and the grass recover? Or, you know, because we were trying to be very prudent with water use, but were there, or are there still steps we could do to with the recovery process?
Right. Well, we could have had, like, for instance, your trees, we could have had a nice layer of organic mulch around the base, maybe all the way out to the drip line. So that would have allowed them to retain moisture a little bit longer during the dry spells, or if you watered them, they would retain it. And that goes for your garden beds as well. So naked soil dries out much quicker than mulched soil. So any kind of organic mulch, being leaves or compost or chips, bark chips, wood chips, anything like that certainly would have helped. Last time we were talking to you all, we talked a lot about drip irrigation. Using irrigation that doesn't water the air but waters the root zone is also a good way to keep things happy. But in general, going forward, we want to pick plants that can handle the changing climate and these unforeseen hot days that we're going to have. It'd be nice to have plants in the ground that are adapted to this kind of weather.
Now, we've talked on this show before frequently about how climate change is affecting many aspects of life in Minnesota. And, you know, to each of you, I'm just curious, you know, how do you think it is affecting gardening? You know, Julie, your thoughts about the effect of climate change on gardening?
Well, I think in Minnesota, as gardeners, we have really been flexible. We've had to be flexible over the time because we have four distinct seasons. And so we kind of move and change with the weather here. And, you know, there's the old saying, if you're not happy with the weather, just wait a few minutes in Minnesota, it'll change. So I think that's one thing is remaining flexible. And also I think, it's important for gardeners to realize that this is not a short-term issue. This is a long-term issue. And we are going to be living with more and more variability in our weather and in the climate patterns that we have. And so choosing, as Catherine said, choosing really resilient plants is important. It's important to understand the site conditions that you have and choose plants according to that. Don't try to grow a lot of plants that need a lot of extra care that are kind of questionable. You can always experiment with things, but really for your, you know, for most of your landscape, choose plants that are going to be really resilient. And you can look to information on extension for that. We have a lot of good plant list information. And also on some of our, at our garden centers, you know, reach out to the experts out there too. But really being resilient and being flexible and also paying attention to your garden. Don't just plant it and walk away, but pay attention to the weather patterns and then treat your plants as needed.
And Catherine, do you think that climate change could affect gardening in the future? And, you know, for people who've planted the same things and done the same things for many, many years are finding that they're going to have to do some things differently moving forward.
Oh, absolutely. Like Julie said, you need to observe what is happening in your garden and how it responds. And also, like she said, to be flexible, because some years we're going to have drought like we did this year, and some years we're going to have too much rain. So that means that gardening is always experimental, right? You put in plants one year, some do well, some don't do well. So I think looking forward, you want to sort of divide your garden into two groups of plants. One are the woody plants, the shrubs and the trees that you put in, you expect them to be there long term. And then your herbaceous plants, your perennials and your annuals that maybe don't cost you as much money and you're willing to put something in one year and lose it by the next year. So you have to, for that group, you don't want to feel like they're so precious. So you're going to put them in one year, you're going to see, did they do well this year? Do I want more of them next year? Or did they not like the heat? Did they not like the extra rain? And you just want to be able to change year to year, depending on what your summer was like. And for the woody plants, you're also worried about the winter. Is it going to be colder than, are they going to get hit by the cold nights, or, you know, or the warm, hot, dry summer is going to do them in. And there's lots of resources out there about which trees and which shrubs are going to be adaptable or more tolerant to the changes in our climate. And I suggest anyone who's about to plant trees or is worrying about the trees or shrubs in their yard, look up those lists. Like, for instance, trees that we sort of love in Minnesota, like maybe quaking aspen or the ash trees and such, those are not going to do well as the climate changes. And there's other trees that will be less, that will be more resilient as the climate changes, like lots of oak trees, certain maple trees, pin oaks, you know, will do better. But we want to keep an eye on the plants that we can do something about year to year, and the plants that we're investing in more. We want to make sure that we pick the right ones.
All right.
We want them to do well for a longer period of time.
Let's get to the phone lines as our listeners start to call in and ask questions about gardening. We're talking about fall gardening with two master gardenings and want to know what you're planting this season and questions that you have about the care of your plants and your trees and your yard. In Minneapolis, we have Jim on the phone. And Jim, what did you want to ask?
Hi. We had some landscaping done about a year ago. Some very nice plants and shrubs, and the threat from climate change wasn't a problem. We were able to do enough watering that the plants themselves did really well. But every bunny in the neighborhood has now decided that this is an all-you-can-eat buffet.
Hey!
And unfortunately, The ones that have struggled the most, we had some azaleas and ended up replacing those with chokeberries, and the bunnies just love those. And we're really frustrated knowing, well, so do we just declare a truce somehow that I don't know about? What is it that we could plant that are those sorts of shrubs that, mm-hmm. That the bunnies aren't gonna deal. We tried some really awful smelling spray that we could, you know, wow. On them, and that worked. Oh, you know, for a day or two, but it was a constant battle because it just didn't last. So we're looking for options that we might have.
Got
with
it.
The small shrubs like that, and when should we plant them if there are some good choices?
Bunny management, Julie and Catherine. I'd love both of you to weigh in on this one. Julie, you can go first.
Well, one of the things you can do is look around your yard and make it as unfavorable to the rabbits as possible. So, for example, if you have brush piles, those are perfect nesting areas for rabbits. If you have areas under your deck that they can get into, that's another great place they like to hang out. So look at how you can exclude them from those areas and then also get rid of those brush piles, weed piles, that kind of thing. That's one thing you can do. The other thing you can do is fence. And nothing repels animals better than a good fence. So the sprays and repellents, they wash off in the rain. Now we didn't have so much rain this year, but they do wear off. And animals become used to them as well. So a good fence, and I recommend using hardware cloth. It's a little quarter-inch square areas that are open, but bury that down a few inches down into the soil. And this is a good practice right now, as we move into winter too, because they'll be feeding on the shrubs in the winter as well. So a barrier protection like that, I know that it doesn't look very good, but it will protect your shrubs. And after a while, the rabbits may go over to your neighbor's yard or down the street and choose to dine on something that's a little easier to access.
All right, Catherine, what do we want people to know about rabbits and bunnies?
Right. Julie's right about everything that she said. However, when you do fencing, the weak point in the fence is always going to be your gate because it has to open, and so you can't bury it down. And so if you do have any place where rabbits can get under or over, they will. So just be aware of that. The one surefire method, which is not fun and doesn't look great, is to cage all of your shrubs in the winter. So you cage them in October, November. You keep a big roll of chicken wire in your garage and you pull it out every year and you cut it to fit around the shrub. And you can also buy wooden stakes that you stake in, maybe three around each shrub. And then that positions the wire so that it surrounds the shrub properly. You can zip tie it. You don't have to zip tie it. And that's pretty foolproof unless the snow gets really high and they can get in from the top if it does end up covering the top. So I generally buy maybe 3 foot high chicken wire and wrap all my shrubs every year until they get too big to wrap. And then I just cross my fingers and, but they're hungry in winter and they will come in your yard. And if you make it easy for them, they will eat everything. And no matter what you plant, there's probably lists of shrubs that rabbits don't like, but that's no guarantee. And they will eat everything that you leave out. They do have preferences. They love this one oak leaf hydrangea they love. They love anything in the like hazelnut and witch hazel. They love those. They love chokeberry, so serviceberry, any of it they will eat. Mm. So if you're going to have woody plants in your yard and you have rabbits, you've got to cage them.
All right, let's take
and just to clarify, I actually was using the term fencing like you used caging. So
I mean the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, basically putting the ring of fencing around each individual shrub or a group of shrubs. Yeah. So we are right on the same page there.
I thought you were being more ambitious, fencing in the entire yard.
No. That would be great, but
let's go to Fridley where Richard is waiting with a question. And Richard, what do you want to ask about fall gardening?
Yeah, I had a question about greenhouse management. I'm looking to have a greenhouse this for the first time this year. It's about 18 by 10. So it's a little, it's a smaller one on the scale of greenhouse, but it's a little bigger for a resident. But I'm looking to grow like greens and vegetables to kind of extend my growing season. And
all right,
who knows, maybe even go into the winter, but we'll see. I've got a plan for using a heating source, but just wondering some tips that I can use for a first time greenhouse grower for vegetables in a greenhouse and managing the challenges of Minnesota greenhouse. Mm.
That sounds like a lot of work, but also a lot of fun. That's Richard and Fridley. And Catherine, I know you can answer this because you're the greenhouse manager there in the Department of Biology at St. Thomas.
Yeah, so good luck. 10 by 18? That's a nice size greenhouse. It sounds like you're trying to get a heat source, so it sounds like for the meantime you're going to have the sun being your heat source, in which case you're using your greenhouse as sort of a season extender, right? So you get a few extra weeks on the beginning and the end of the growing season, which is also a great use of it. Tips for greenhouse growing is that find a good seed source. I know Johnny Selected Seeds has lots of information on their website about seeds that are actually being are grown for greenhouse use. So they've been bred to grow in greenhouses, and which means you're growing them probably in a peat moss soil substrate instead of in the soil, right? Instead of in the ground. So select the right varieties, check your water ahead of time to make sure you've got decent water. Your crops will only grow as well as the water source. So send your water out to have the alkalinity tested, and then make sure you're using a decent fertilizer as well. Then you're going to have to worry about pests. So every plant you grow in a greenhouse is delicious to pests as much as it is to you. So just get some good resources and learn a lot about growing in greenhouses, because it's fun, but it's not as easy as it seems. Mm-hmm. And good luck.
All right. I want to share a question I'm getting on Twitter. This is from Heather. And Heather says, Angela, any suggestions for dry, burnt yards? What to do now versus what to do in the spring? Ooh, Heather has been by my house. Yes, it looks burnt. Some of the grass in our yards. And this is something, Julie, that maybe you can help us with lawn care. What do we do trying to recover and being hopeful that we'll see green grass again in the spring?
Yeah, definitely. Before we do that, I just want to mention a resource that we have on Extension called Deep Winter Greenhouses. That uses a passive solar power energy and is designed for the type of growing I think that the previous caller was looking for. So you can go to our extension site at extension.umn.edu and just type in deep winter greenhouses, and you should be able to find that publication. It's pretty interesting. But regarding the lawns, yeah, boy. So our grasses that we grow in most of our lawns are cool season grasses. And they go into a natural dormancy in the heat of the summer. And this year, we seem to have a longer dormancy. And these lawns can go dormant for about a month. After that, they start to die. Mm. So we've had some rain now recently. So in the next few days, if you start to see your lawn green up, then you are lucky and those plants are still alive. But what do you do about it to make sure that you recover for next year? You can do a couple things. As we have these cooler nights, and whenever we're going to be having some rain forecasted, throw down some seed, get some good quality seed, go buy some new seed so that it's fresh, and put that down. And then try to do that every few, whenever you can, every few weeks or so, you can try to do that. That will help to bring back your lawn. And then also the other option is dormant seeding. Dormant seeding is done around mid-November or so. And the seed lies dormant. It is too cold by that time for the seed to germinate. It lies dormant until spring when there's moisture and temperatures that are appropriate, and then it starts to germinate. So you get a kind of a jump start on your lawn for next year. So look for those different things. We have some good information, another bit of information in our Yard and Garden News that is written by our extension educator and turf, Maggie Ryder. So take a look at that on our website as well.
We are talking about fall gardening and taking your questions. The number to call is 651-227-6000. Again, the number is 651-227-6000 as we talk with our two master gardeners who have great advice for us in Woodbury. Kristen's on the phone. And Kristen, what is your question this morning?
Hi, I'm interested in season extension in my vegetable garden. But I try to avoid buying plastic when I can, and it seems like a lot of the options I have are plastic-based. I was wondering if like there's any type of row cover that isn't a fabric that's plastic, or any other options I would have for that.
So you're trying to extend the growing season of your plants? Okay. Catherine, is that something you want to tackle?
Boy, non-synthetic, non-plastic, transparent growing materials. Julie, I'm coming a blank other than glass for that. How about you?
Well, there could be, could use cold frames maybe. That might be one option.
Right.
That would be something
glass.
You could,
yeah.
Yeah, it would be glass and usually made out of wood or sometimes metal, and that can be used over and over. We have certainly biodegradable and photodegradable alternatives to plastic mulches. So those are some options too. That's for mulch, though, not for a covering. But yeah, it's hard to do it without using plastic. The good thing about it is unless the plastic gets ripped, it would be reusable. So you wouldn't be throwing it away every year.
All right. And I want to take another call. Now we've got in Belle Plaine. LaVon is on the line. LaVon, what is your question?
Good morning. Typically, I wait to dig all of my flower bulbs after the frost. But because I have so many canna and calla lily bulbs and dahlia bulbs and gladiolas, I'm wondering if it would harm the bulbs to dig them before the frost.
Okay, bulbs. Yeah, so this is a time for a lot of planting, I guess, is what she's asking about. What do you think about that, Julie?
Well, those are actually tender bulbs that she's talking about, Angela. They're bulbs that we actually dig up in the fall and save over the winter replant in the spring.
Okay.
So they're summer blooming bulbs and tubers and corms and other kind of storage devices that are plant-based. So I think that you could go ahead, and Catherine, you might have more experience with this than I do, but I think you could go ahead and dig them up. You just want to be sure that they're stored someplace to dry and cure, and that's cool and not too warm. Don't put them in your garage because we might still get some hot days. And then, of course, planting fall bulbs also, as Angela was referring to, is important too, and that's daffodils and plants that need to go, you know, tulips that need to go through a cold period through the winter. But I think you could start digging them up. We're getting into chilly nights, and it looks like the forecast is pretty cool. We're getting into more fallish weather. Okay. Catherine, I don't know if you've, you know...
No, I mean, I agree. Sometimes you have to do it when you have the time.
Right.
And it sounds like she has figured out how much work she has to do and when she can do it. So go for it.
In Shoreview, Linda is on the phone. And Linda, what question do you have about gardening this fall?
Hi. I just moved from Minneapolis to Shoreview, and the soil is entirely different here. It's very sandy. I am an avid gardener, and two things. I planted a berm, and I'm concerned about the plantings lasting through the winter, although I've mulched. And then I also want to plant some apple trees, and I'm wondering if it's too late or where a good source to find an apple tree would be.
Planting trees. Julie, you want to tackle that?
Sure. I would wait actually till spring. I would look for bare root apple trees that are grown locally or in Minnesota and order them and have them shipped to you. The good thing about bare root trees is that they are, they establish faster. They are also, smaller, but they can adapt better to the conditions. And you sometimes can get better varieties and more choices. However, they are very limited in the spring. There's only a certain window that they ship these plants because they are dormant plants and they have to be kept cool and moist. So you want to be ready to plant them as soon as you get them. The difference would be buying a containerized plant, which again, I'd still wait till spring and go ahead and buy those. And then containerized plants, you can wait a couple of days, keep them watered and then get them in the ground. But bare root plants, they're pretty inexpensive. That's another real benefit to them too. And so I would go ahead and I just wait till then and then, you know, see what you can do about ordering the varieties that you want. Remember that you need two different cultivars to cross-pollinate as well.
And there are some opportunities to I think, like get free trees, right? Aren't there places you can get like small trees to plant? There's some organizations that want you to plant trees. And so they're, you know, you can get them for free. You don't always have to buy these young trees.
Yeah. Sometimes the like National Arbor Day has giveaways. But these are very tiny seedlings and mm-hmm. they're not always the tree that somebody's looking for. Mm-hmm. You know, they make a decision and say, we're going to do, you know, white spruce or something. And you get a little white spruce the size of your big finger. So I think that mm-hmm. she wants to get a little bit bigger head start on that too. The question about the soil is important too. And you have sandy soil. So you want to be mixing in organic matter like compost that will help to improve the water holding capacity of that soil and make that available to your new plants.
We're talking about fall gardening. I want to hear from you. How has the drought affected your trees, your plants, your yard? What are you planning to plant this season? What questions do you have for our two master gardeners? You can call us at 651-227-6000. Tweet me at Angela Davis, NPR. Now back to the conversation about fall gardening. My guest today, Julie Weisenhorn, an extension educator and associate extension professor in the University of Minnesota's Department of Horticultural Science, and Catherine Grant, a horticulturalist and greenhouse manager in the Department of Biology at the University of St. Thomas. And we have the phone lines open if you want to ask some questions. We want to hear from you. What did the drought do to your plants, to your yard, to your grass? What questions do you have about what to plant, how to get your yards and gardens prepared for the winter months to come? Give us a call at 651-227-6000. Again, 651-227-6000. Let's go back to the phone lines in Brooklyn Center. John has been waiting. Good morning, John. What did you want to ask?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I had a question about winter gardening, specifically regarding forcing bulbs over the winter. I saw on the U of M website last year a technique where you could put in hyacinth, daffodil, tulip bulbs, and then water them in little 4-inch pots, put them in the refrigerator, and then October, November, December, they can go into dormancy, but then we bring them out in January for some blooming. And it actually worked, sort of. The ones that I put it in the little college fridge, and the ones that were closer to the freezer got kind of burnt and frozen, and they never did bloom. But the other ones, you know, you could kind of see the shoots coming up, and they kind of bloomed kind of all at once. So it was great, you know, January, you know, early February to have some blossoms and lots of color. But is there a way to spread those out a little more if I want to try that again and then maybe use a little bigger refrigerator?
Mm. Wow, he's asking about indoor bulb gardens. Wow, that's a lot going on there. Catherine, you want to go first on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I have also done that before, but I had access to a walk-in refrigerator and then a greenhouse. So it made it a little bit easier. I can't imagine what is the size of a refrigerator that you can do this. You can, if you want to stagger the time, then you stagger when you bring them out of the refrigerator. Also, you just manipulate how much light and warmth they get during the daytime to either speed up the bloom or slow down the bloom. Once again, not having a greenhouse to do that in, I'm not sure how you can do that, but it sounds like you're enterprising and you can figure that out. But it's just basically that when they bloom is a function of heat and sunlight. And obviously water. So if you can stagger when you put them in the refrigerator, when you take them out, that's the way to stagger it. And also different varieties will have different days to maturity. So you can also monkey around with which varieties you're putting in your fridge and when you take them out. Good luck with that.
Julie, any advice?
All good advice from Catherine. So I there's nothing better for using an old fridge than either storing beer or forcing bulbs.
I didn't even know that. Okay. Another phone call in Minneapolis. Michael's on the phone. Hi, Michael. Michael, are you there? We can hear you.
For the show.
Yeah, go right ahead, Michael. You're on.
Yeah. So the drought made us really intensify our conversation about our lawn.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering about replacing our Kentucky bluegrass dominant lawn with Minnesota native, more drought tolerant, and wondering whether what time of the year that's best to do and resources to find out the best process for doing that.
All right, Michael, thinking about changing things up with his grass. Julie, any suggestions there? How to do that?
Well, all good ideas. The first thing is the question is, if you want to have ornamental grasses and have garden beds instead of lawns, you can certainly find a lot of great ornamental grasses that are drought tolerant. But if you're looking for just a different type of grass for your lawn, I would recommend the fine fescues and the tall fescue. They are really tough grasses. They stay green longer into the fall. They also are low nutrient. They have low nutrient requirements. They tolerate drought. They grow well in sun and part shade. And they are a really good alternative to some of our higher maintenance Kentucky bluegrass. So you can take a look. Look for the fine fescues. There's creeping fescue, chewing's fescue, sheep's fescue, a bunch of different fescues in that respect. Then you can look on the labels for those. That would be the first thing. And then when to do it, as we mentioned a little bit earlier in the show, that you can start to seed now when we have some cooler, damp weather coming. So watch the weather reports for rain. Put that seed down. You can do that every couple of weeks up until November. Once you get into November, you're doing what's called dormant seeding. And at that point, the seed is not going to germinate. So it will germinate in the spring. And so those are a couple of options that you can do. You're looking for seed to soil contact too. So you want to actually use, maybe scratch up the soil in the areas that you need to reseed, maybe mow your lawn very short, mm-hmm. and then do your seeding.
Let's take another call. This is Diane on the line. Hi, Diane. You're in Brinson. Is that correct?
That's right. Hi, good morning.
Hi. What's your question?
Well, I have a hydrangea that mm-hmm. is, this is the third year for it, and it's a gorgeous plant, but it has absolutely not a bloom in sight. And I wondered if I trimmed it back too far last year and what I should do this fall.
All right. She's got a hydrangea in distress. Catherine, can you help her with that?
Yeah, sure. There's about three different species of hydrangea that we sell in Minnesota. It sounds like, I'm not sure, maybe you have the one with the big leaves and that has blue or purple blossoms that you're waiting for blooms from, because those maybe are a little bit trickier. The general rule of thumb for plants that bloom in the spring is that you trim them after they bloom, and then during the course of summer, they will set up the blooms for next year. So you never want to prune a shrub that's going to bloom in the spring in the winter, because their buds are already there. Their flower buds are already set. So you will cut off all the flower buds. So that's one reason why you might not have had any blooms. Other reasons are light requirements, the heat. Maybe it's too much in the shade, too much in the sun. I guess not knowing which hydrangea you're talking about, I really can't answer it specifically.
But. Well, Catherine, I want to share this question I'm getting on Twitter. This is from Ava, and she's asking, she says, we have peonies that have been looking pretty sad due to the drought. Mm-hmm. Is there something we can do to help them so they come back and bloom well next year? Now, I just also would like to add, in Virginia, we pronounce that peony. We call them peonies, but I recognize now people here say peonies. So she has a sad peony. What should she do there,
Ava? A sad peony. Well, I mean, the summer and the damage has already happened, right? The thing that made it look sad has happened. Peonies also often look not so great this time of year because they're done blooming. Their leaves look a little haggard. Maybe.
Mine never bloomed in my backyard. Oh, they didn't bloom at all.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. So in terms of general care, like keep it nice, water it in for winter so that it makes sure it's got it's stored energy into its roots, and next spring, just keep an eye out for it. They come up so early in the spring. Mm-hmm. But honestly, I think the damage has already been done, and it's the horses out of the barn. We had a bad summer and things have suffered.
Wow. Okay. All right. Yeah. In Eden Prairie, Bill's on the phone. Bill, thank you for waiting. What is your question?
Well, first of all, can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead, Bill. Mm-hmm.
Okay. We just had a massive amount of landscaping done around our house. I mean, they came in and cut everything down with a bobcat down 6 inches, and they put plants every place. And then they rolled out the matting, and the holes for the matting are a lot larger to where the plants went. And he said it would be maintenance-free, but every single day I go out there, and there's nothing but daylilies and prickers coming up in the hole they cut for the matting. And I can't believe the depth of daylily's roots, because to get them out, I've got to go down about a foot to get the daylilies out. And the landscaper told me, I'll just bust them off from where they are coming out of the ground and you'll be good. But I do that and they keep coming back. So my first question is there anything I can do about all these weeds?
Oh, wow. Bill, you do not sound
happy.
Everything. You sound very frustrated, Bill.
Well, if my wife is listening, which she probably is, she'll laugh to death.
Okay.
Because she says, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. But we put so much money into this landscaping.
Right.
And every day I go out there and there's just more daylilies and more pricklers.
Okay.
And I'm out there every day bending down and pulling them out, and they're all coming up through the holes in the matting.
All right. Well, let's get you some help, some advice, Bill. Julie, I'll start with you. Any advice for Bill?
So when you say matting, Bill, are you talking about landscape fabric?
Yes.
Okay, black fabric. And so that it's coming up the holes where you planted the new shrubs, and so it's coming up next to your shrubs?
Yes. And to dig down, I have to basically take the shrub out.
Sure. Yeah. Understandable. Are you sure that they're daylilies?
Yes. Because at the end of the roots on the daylilies, there's a number of bulbs.
Okay.
Like lots of bulbs that are attached to the root.
Okay. So I think that there's a couple things to do. First of all, I sympathize with you, and I'm really sorry to hear that has happened. Knocking them off is not the answer for either the thistle or the daylilies. And the reason for that is you're leaving the root behind. And I know you've been trying to dig it out and you have to dig down so far. The thistle roots are going to go down a couple of feet probably. So really the best thing to do is going to be to treat those plants and not try to dig them out. Now, how do you do that without harming your plant that you just bought? And so you want to put a barrier between the plant that you want to keep and these other plants, and you want to dab a non-selective or broadleaf herbicide onto the offensive plants, and then go ahead and, you know, there's a couple different varieties. You can use one of these spongy paint brushes with a little plastic container and just carefully dab that on. Put a piece of cardboard between those offensive plants and the plant you want to keep, so that you don't harm the plant you want to keep. Just leave it there until the leaves dry. And by doing that, you're going to actually send that pesticide or that herbicide down into the roots of the plant, and that's going to kill the plant. But trying to pull it out is just going to, you're going to continue to have the same issues that you've been fighting all summer.
Catherine, any advice for Bill?
Oh, boy. Well, one thing is that there's no such thing as a maintenance-free yard. So
that's right.
You will always have weeds. It sounds like you had daylilies before, and they just were pretty much entrenched. And thistles also can live for, you know, the seeds live for 100 years. So you're always going to have seeds that blow in on the wind from trees, from shrubs, from neighbors' yards. So there's no such thing as a maintenance-free yard. I mean, Julie's advice is good. Another way to kill weeds without using a pesticide is to maybe get a propane torch, and you can actually direct that towards the weeds, and it kills them by heat. You might have a little more fun doing that. But otherwise, good luck. It sounds like sort of a nightmare situation.
All right. Good luck, Bill. Let's take a phone call from Duluth, where Britta is on the line. Good morning, Britta.
Hi.
Hi. What's going on at your house?
I just have a question now that pumpkins and winter squash are ripening. I have a question about curing, especially up here in Duluth. We have a lot cooler temperatures. So I'm just wondering, now that they're finally ripe and I can take them from the vine, I know most people cure them outside, but should I be curing them inside for a warmer temperature? Just a question about that.
Okay. And this is a good question because I don't even know what that means. What is curing pumpkins? Catherine?
I know very little about it because I've never done it. But so I'm going to punt that one to Julie because I'm sure she's got those specs
Julie,
on her fingertips.
What is curing pumpkins? What does that involve?
Well, curing pumpkins is as those pumpkins and squash ripen, that rind becomes really firm, and they're ready to pick when you cannot dent them with your fingernail. So then they are ready to go. And also the vines will start to decline. They'll start to kind of get woody, and you'll know at that point that they're ready to pick. So that's when you should harvest them. Once you've harvested them, you can store them at about 55 degrees. So if you have a garage that's, maybe heated in the winter, you can fire it up to about 50 degrees and store it there. Relative humidity, 50%. I know that's hard to measure in Minnesota, and they'll last about 1 to 6 months. So, you can leave them out on your front porch also, but you want to take them inside if a hard frost is projected. So, after sitting outside, for a month or so, you should eat them pretty quickly at that point. So the outdoor conditions will decrease the shelf life. So storing them inside is in that kind of cooler environment is going to be better than storing them outside. And I'm actually looking right at a really great article that was written by my colleague, Natalie Hoidl. And it is all about melons, pumpkins, and it's called A Quick Guide to Harvesting and Storing Melons, Squash, and Pumpkins. So you can take a look at that and get a little bit more information.
And Catherine, I want to make sure we get to a question I have. You know, what should we be doing now to prepare our gardens and yards for the cold winter months ahead? Just some good advice just for everyone in general. Like, okay, already today we're here in the Twin Cities. It's, cooler today. But as we think about the winter months coming, what's some good things to do as we may be heading indoors?
Yeah, sure. One of the first things that I'd like to say is that I think we all have a tendency to want to tidy up our yards sort of as if they're our living rooms. We want to put everything away. We want to cut everything down. We want to sort of vacuum up
right?
We want to have nothing left on the ground. We want to sort of strip it all down so it looks good to us. And I think we have to pause a moment and think about, is this what's good for the insects and the wildlife that live in our little piece of land? And one thing that's really important that we all want to do this time of year is we want to go out and buy our leaf bags and get our rakes out, get the family outside, rake up all the leaves, put them in bags, and ship them off to a big compost site somewhere. And that is really the worst thing you can do for the insects and the little critters that live in your yard. Because most of the butterflies and moths and bees, they need a layer of leaf litter on the ground in your yards in order to overwinter. So there's a lot of butterflies and moths. They don't migrate. They actually drop either their pupa, their chrysalis, a caterpillar, or the adult needs to burrow under something to stay warm for the winter. And bumblebee queens that overwinter need a layer of leaf mulch in order to overwinter successfully. And when we rake everything up or blow it with our leaf blowers, we're disturbing a habitat that's very, very important to the successful life of all of those insects. And so I think the most important thing to me this year is that less people rake less leaves and export less leaves off of their yards. They should keep them somewhere in your yard. Now, you don't want them on your lawn because obviously that's not usually a good thing for the health of your lawn. So if you have garden beds, and if you can rake the leaves or blow the leaves onto the garden beds, it's free mulch. Mm-hmm. It provides moisture. It provides a hiding place for all of these beneficial insects for the winter. And it's also, they're free nutrients that nourish the trees they fell off of and nourish the plants in your garden by feeding all the micro the microbial animals that are in your soil, like the fungi, the bacteria, the invertebrates are in your soil. Your soil is actually a living place. It's a very diverse ecosystem, and it needs organic matter in order to be healthy and survive and recycle nutrients. So here's my big tip. Do not rake your leaves off your site. Put them in your beds if you can, and allow that to be a habitat for insects. And the second thing is, we all want to cut our perennials down so they look tidy. We should leave those up as much as we can, especially if they have seed heads that are feeding the local bird population. So if you have a bird feeder and you're putting bird feed out, just look for a second and see if the birds are actually feeding on top of your plants and eating the seeds that are there, because they probably are. Leave those up as long as you can so that the birds can take advantage of them. And then when you do cut down your perennials, probably do it in the spring and only cut, never cut lower than 12 inches. And that's because of stem-dwelling bees need those as habitat sites to nest in the following spring.
So, Catherine, you want people to remember that our yards and gardens, that that this is a wildlife habitat.
It is a wildlife habitat. We share that with them, and we want to do our part to make it a healthy living ecosystem for all of those creatures. It's not just for our eyeballs and our aesthetic, and for our neighbors who we all copy and try and make it look as tidy as possible.
Ooh. Okay.
Yeah. Amen.
Ooh, let's take another phone call. In St. Paul, Marge is on the line. Marge, thank you for waiting. What did you want to share or ask?
Thanks for the great show. Always learning. Mm-hmm. Here's my question. Want to plant more trees, and thinking specifically about the climate change issues that we're all that we all live in, is there a benefit of a leaf tree opposed to a needle tree in terms of helping that situation? Thanks.
Thanks, Marge. Julie, I'll let you take that one.
I think it's important to diversify your trees, and it's great that you're thinking of both the deciduous trees. Those are the trees with the leaves that drop off in the fall. And then also the evergreen trees, and those are, of course, our needle trees, our trees with foliage like arborvitae. So it's important to have diversity. So I think there's room for both kinds of trees in your property. The important thing is to choose a tree that is suited to the growing conditions that you have, the type of soil, the amount of light, and most importantly, the amount of space. Now, think about the shape of a deciduous tree. It's like a vase. It's up, it's narrow at the bottom. You get a nice canopy. It canopies over your yard, over other plants, over your deck and patio. Great. With an evergreen tree, such as a spruce or a pine, you're going to need a lot more room for that tree on the floor of your landscape or in your yard, because those branches are dense and they are going to spread outward and take up a lot more room from that respect. So be sure to just measure your space and then choose a plant that is going to grow in that space, and you have lots of room for it. One of the saddest things is when you see evergreens that are planted too close together, and then they're deformed, they have issues with humidity, lots of problems, branches that die, they don't get enough sun. So be sure that you space your plants out appropriately and really look at the size of the plant, and that will help you a lot.
And in our last 2 minutes here, I'm going to try to take a quick call in St. Paul. Leslie's on the phone. And Leslie, could you ask your question quickly?
Yeah, hi. Okay. My question is about my purple cone flowers, which I've had a nice, healthy couple of clumps blooming every year for 3 or 4 years. And this year, something awful happened. I don't know what it is, but they barely put up the most pathetic looking 2 or 3 blossoms, and the stems were black. And so I would think there's some kind of disease. I kind of Googled it, and there was some kind of disease that suggested black stems or black leaves. I didn't have black leaves, but I had black stems, and I kept cutting them back, and they would bud and never bloom because...
Okay, Marge, I want to ask Catherine if she has any suggestions, just based on that information, Catherine, about what's going on with her purple cone flowers.
Right. The black stems is maybe not going to fit in with what I'm going to say, but aster yellows, it's a viral disease that is pretty common in cone flowers. They get distorted in weird shapes.
Catherine, I'm so sorry. And I'm sorry I couldn't get the answer in, but we're out of time. I want to thank our two guests there, Catherine Grant, Julie Weisenhorn. You're the best. We appreciate you. We'll talk to you tomorrow at 9. Today's show was produced by Samantha Matsumoto.
Programming is supported by the Shakopee Mitawakatin Sioux Community, a sovereign tribal nation in Scott County, now hiring. Learn more about the tribe at ShakopeeDakota.org and at its public exhibit in Shakopee.
Thanks for listening to a recording of my live radio show on NPR News. A reminder, if you want to catch the show in real time, tune in and call in at a new time, 9 a.m. weekdays on NPR News.